CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 77 with Dr. Ralph Chu, Secrets to Success and Lessons We Learned the Hard Way. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special friend, a very dear friend for more than 20 years. That is Ralph Chu in Minneapolis. Ralph, welcome to our podcast.
Uday, thank you so much. God, we've been friends for like over 25 years.
I know, don't remind me. It's been a long time. I think we first met maybe early 2000s, around right in the year 2000. I finished residency and I was just like, who is this young superstar? You were everywhere. You had just finished your training and I saw you as like the poster boy for, I think at the time you were doing like AMO lenses.
Yes.
Fake machine. You were like, you were everything.
Yeah, I got really lucky. You know, when I started 25 years ago, LASIK had just gotten approved. And it's amazing to see that, over 25 years, you know, both you and I have been able to answer the question that we always got asked at cocktail parties, like, hey, can you help me get rid of my glasses?
Right.
And that's how that career started. Now, 25 years later, we have so many more ways of getting to yes, right? We say stuff like, hey, can you help me get rid of my reading glasses? And now right. We have that ability to talk to people. But it was crazy times back then. I mean, LASIK, it was an honor. I think when you and I were both starting, we had gone from extracap to phaco.
Right.
And we learned the birth of phaco emulsification, and surgeons were still, like, I still had to learn how to do extracaps in residency.
Yeah, and I had to do 10 extracaps before I was allowed to do phaco.
Right. And now it's a totally different ballgame. And so to be able to witness the birth of these major revolutionary technologies like phaco and then have LASIK and all the other presbyopia type advanced lenses has been, I think, one of the greatest privileges over 25 years.
It's been amazing. Even how like LASIK has changed, like the original lasers, how slow they were, and how the beds keep drying out. You have to adjust your nomogram, don't fully treat the myopia. And there's no trackers at the time. Remember, there were no trackers. You had to hold the head.
Yeah, I remember like to get a smooth ablation, on one of the original lasers, we had to vibrate the patient's head a little bit.
Yeah.
And you talk to the surgeons nowadays and they're like, what? That's unbelievable. So it has been a great, like you said, I was really, really, I still am, I'm really proud to be involved in the evolution of the field, right? If you look back 25 years ago, we had one presbyopia correcting IOL, the Array by AMO.
Yeah, I remember.
Right?
And it was priced the same as any monofocal lens too.
Oh, the way of the, yes. That's a whole different subject, right? Reimbursement changes and things, but, we've done a lot of clinical trials over the years. We've done over 115 clinical trials. And, when I think back and see like, the ICL, the stents, the first multifocal IOLs. Mm-hmm. Now we have two, trials on the latest generation excimer lasers. Just watching like and being part, intimately involved in how the field evolved is so cool, and the ways we're able to make patients happy, that's been the most gratifying thing. So, it's been fun to, you were everywhere too. That's how we knew each other, man. Yeah. We just keep meeting at all the different meetings, and that's changed a lot too in 25 years.
Oh, I know. I'm almost a little hesitant to even discuss some of it, but like the young people may not know that it was a different world back then. To be a key opinion leader, consult with these companies, very different up until maybe 07, 08, when kind of the guidelines changed.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, you've been pretty, pretty clear on, the viewpoint, and I completely agree with how you see things. And, I think it's important to keep moving the field forward. Yeah. I think it's also important to realize the power that, the physicians actually have in terms of that connection with the patient, right? We're still the ones that are licensed to actually utilize and treat and use these technologies to help improve people's vision. And so, sometimes the less experienced generation, I should say, may not have all that perspective, and I think we're really lucky to have that perspective.
Yeah, keep in mind for any young surgeons, if you're in your 30s or 40s, no matter what, it's always your fault. You're the captain of the ship. You're the one who takes all the liability anytime you do a case,
And don't just give it away, man. Don't just give it away.
Right, exactly. That, you know what? The insight you have is so valuable. And another good important lesson for the young ophthalmologists is, because their fields change so much, we're self-taught. No one taught me in residency how to do things that didn't exist then, right? You got to like learn it on your own. You want to learn, how I learned how to do lamellar corneal transplantation? By watching videos. by emailing other docs, like, hey, can you tell me, how'd you do this and this? And then I put together a series of videos on Cataract Coach, and I watched them 100 times myself. Then I started doing it, and then I started teaching residents.
Learning how to learn. I think
for sure.
From what I see out there, there's the surgeons that continue to improve and to kind of push the field forward are the ones that, you know, are able to learn, you know, get that street knowledge is what you're talking about. You know, watch another surgeon, watch a video, ask a colleague, have confidence in their abilities, and then actually know how to teach themselves in a safe fashion.
Right.
Don't just jump in and say, hey, I saw this on a video, so I'm just going to try it, without knowing like where you're at with your own skills and, you know, how to first do no harm. And I think you nailed it. You know, you do a lot of teaching. I was involved with residencies and fellowships, you know, throughout my journey as well. And I think learning how to learn, maybe what you learn from a mentor is how they learn. And maybe that's how you can figure out how you learn. And then that's how you keep moving yourself forward over your career.
Absolutely fantastic advice. Yeah, I had a great time teaching residents. I did it from 2000 to 2022. So it's been a couple of years since I taught a resident, hands in hands in the OR. But fantastic time. That's probably another important thing, that the importance of changing gears in life. There are different stages here in your career.
Absolutely. I think, you know, if I look back, I think, you know, when you're first starting, you're trying to establish yourself. You're trying to see, you know, what your limits are, you know, and discover your why. I think really that's one of the things, like, how do you want to practice? There's so many ways. The practice landscape has changed now in 2024, where, you know, 80% of doctors in general, not just ophthalmologists, are now employed in some fashion, whether it's through a corporate system, a hospital system, or, you know, there's less and less independent doctors, you know, and one of the last independent, you know, doctors in our community here, and very proud of it, but that's my why. And so, and my why is to try to, you know, preserve that direct patient physician relationship and be able to have, you know, a direct say in how, you know, the conversation goes between the patients who choose to come to us and not. So, but you know, that's not the only way to practice. So being adaptable has been really the biggest thing, you know, trying to figure out how to navigate the changing reimbursement landscape, how to grow with new technologies, and how to, you know, and we've been lucky to take all that and still move the field forward through clinical trial work, which has been gratifying. So, changing your life career. I've learned a lot from watching your journey as well. Personally, how do you balance that, what you need in your personal life with your family, with your personal self-care, and all the demands of the professional life, which is maintaining your practice, take care of patients, working with industry, speaking around the world. And, you know, that's one of the greatest things is knowing colleagues all around the world.
Yeah, it really is. Ophthalmology is such a cool little family.
Yeah,
it's just amazing to have these friendships with people worldwide for so many years. It's a really neat thing.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, even having fun over the years, you know, I think both of us are friends with a well-known surgeon, Sri Ganesh. Dressing up in costumes and doing some skits at ASCRS with him. And
yeah,
I remember doing my first live surgery in Hong Kong with him. And, you know, we're sitting there in the pre-surgical area and I was nervous, now it's like, I've done live surgery on four different continents. And it's just one of those things in my past, but, to see him and kind of relate those stories, like you and I, we saw each other doing surgery in different places. And it's been amazing.
You know, the live surgery was one of my favorite things. I ended up doing more than 20 live surgery events across the world.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Man. That's
not so common anymore, you know, especially at U.S. meetings. International meetings are still doing it, but at U.S. meetings, I almost rarely see live surgery.
It was the best. Remember that? That was the session that was packed out of the doors.
Yeah, right.
And it was a little bit like the Colosseum in Rome, though. We weren't really there to see the surgery go well. In fact, if it went well, it was like, it was more fun to talk about, I can't believe that happened.
Right. No, that was a fun thing. Yeah, some people may not know. Last surgery was very tough because you have extra camera angles. So you can see, like, you know, close-ups of the eye. There's a camera like 2 inches from the eye, plus your microscope view, plus your hand view. And then even you have to sometimes hold the instruments differently so you don't block the cameras.
And then somebody's talking in your ear.
Two earpieces. You got the director saying, "Set up the camera, focus down," and then you've got in the other one the moderator who's in the audience, hopefully asking you about what you're doing. Like if I'm doing if I'm doing the Rex, don't ask me about the IOL. I can't chew. I cannot chew gum and walk at the same time. Like, you can't do one thing at a time.
So it's like doing your podcast without editing real time.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
But no, I think live surgery is a neat thing. I'm not sure exactly why that's kind of fallen out of favor. I thought there was just a lot to learn from it, and it was always exciting. But yeah, I mean, good news is a lot of the international music still happens quite a bit. I was just in Brazil, and they have like multiple rooms going at the same time.
Oh, yeah. I saw some of that online, and that's a whole new thing too. I mean, this whole online thing. Right. I'm learning a lot from your, you know, just like your cataract coach. I mean, that's a great service you've provided. I mean, you know, so this online thing has been great, but yeah, I think live surgery is, yeah, it's really important. And I think, I don't know, I'm not sure. I have some ideas on why maybe it's harder to do in the United States, but it's too bad. I miss those days.
But like you said, you know, I guess things change. So one thing I looked up a little bit on your background.
Yeah.
You were one of those really smart high schoolers. You did the 6-year bachelor MD program. You were like every mom's dream son.
Yeah, every tiger mom's golden child right here. You know, and I played the violin, man. Hey, right?
Violin? And you had the 6-year MD program?
Yep, a violinist who went to be a doctor. That's like the dream.
It's so fun. It was different times then. Yeah, you're right. It was just like.
It was. I was the last of the 6-year meds at Northwestern Medical School. Now it's a 7-year program. Yeah, I'm not even sure if they still have it, but it's a 7-year program after I left. And I just had my 40th violin school reunion. So I actually pulled out the violin, practiced.
No way.
And went back for the final concert of my violin teacher in Chicago. She's 93.
Oh, wow.
And a bunch of us alumni who are now, you know, in midlife, who grew up together intensely during our high school years. And, you know, the body remembers, you know, I could play the songs without music still. I mean, it's crazy. So that was a lot of fun. We saw a lot of people I grew up. So one of them is a professor teaching medical students, you know, now. I'm like, wow.
Yeah, I guess, of all the students, how many became doctors and engineers? Right.
Actually, probably several of them. Three, four, right off the top of my head, are professional musicians all around the world performing. And one of the friends, you know, Roddy, he actually, you know, he performed with Celine Dion and some of these, you know, famous, you know, pop musicians. And so, yeah, that's been cool to see. So the professional musician side is cool. But then, yeah, others are professional teachers now. They teach violin. Actually in my class, probably the only person that's a doctor is like me. So that's odd.
Is that because you weren't good enough to be a professional violinist?
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Well, that's awesome. The other amazing thing people may not know is like, you finish your fellowship and you say, you know what? I'm going solo.
Yeah, I've been 25 years solo now. And I think that was a great, you know, that was a gift for me. And so I think it's been an incredible journey. This is our 25th year today. In practice. Wow. Practice. Yeah. Yeah. So it's been incredible to watch the practice grow, to see that we're not only surviving, but we're thriving out here. And you know, I think we're doing, you know, great things and the best we can for the people in our community. It's been awesome. It's been the way to go. I'm having an associate join me this year.
Wow.
Yeah, look at that. That's a big deal.
That's a really big deal.
Yeah, going from a bachelor to a, you know, into a relationship. It's a little bit daunting.
can we ask yet who's your new associate?
I'm really proud of her. Her name is Marianne Sullivan, and she's coming out of the Navy, and so, you know, has you know, some experience in terms of managing her own clinics, you know, during surgery. Nice. You know, doing overseas work, and I'm really proud that she served our country. It's pretty cool, and so she's going to start this September with us.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, very proud of that.
I think you're going to love it. You're going to love having a young associate kind of keep you young, teach you some new stuff. And then obviously you teach them as well.
Yeah. I think that, that mentorship is a huge thing, you know, passing on. You said different phases of life.
Right.
I think, we've both reached that stage where, you know, you want to give back, you know, sure. You want to determine what determines your significance. You know, some of us, you know, I think your cataract coach is like, you know, basically a fellowship for the world, which is cool. Right. Some people take on fellows, but somehow just passing it on. So, you know, future generations of patients also benefit from some of the knowledge we've gained over the years too. I think that's kind of the next phase.
Right. No, for sure. Like one of the things that I wish I had help with is when I first started practice, it's just talking to patients. Like it's different when you're cranking through a county hospital or a big VA hospital and you've got this big line of patients out the door and you're in private practice. First, the big challenge is get the patient in the door. There's no waiting line for you.
That's it.
Getting patients is tough. And then just the way you interact with patients, it just takes a lot of time to really understand and learn that.
Yeah, I remember we've had a lot of these conversations over the years too. And I think when I watch and listen and, you know, of interviewing some of these younger doctors, it seems like one of the gaps in their education is, you know, emotional intelligence in managing patients, right?
Sure.
Like, you know, we're expected to be able to talk to patients about choosing different technologies, premium IOLs, different surgical techniques. And yet, you know, understanding the patient's fears, understanding how they respond, how they make decisions, how they need to receive information, how they handle uncertainty are some of the biggest challenges. And none of that has to do with surgery.
Right.
And many of us, you know, are really, really excellent at surgery and technical skills and technical knowledge. You know, to get an ophthalmology, you had to be top of your class. And yet, you know, those skills don't necessarily patients don't judge you based on those skills. They don't look
right. They don't know.
They don't look at your transcript. They don't care. They just say, do I like this guy? Or, you know, do I like this doctor? Do I trust this person? And, you know, do they see and understand me?
Right.
And so, how do you get to that? And, you know, there's a lot of stuff to master technically, so I can understand why, you know, but I think there's also this lack of emphasis on, you know, the emotional intelligence side of dealing with human beings under a stressful situation. They're making life-changing decisions with really no skill, no background to make those decisions. Mm-hmm. So all based on trust and emotion. That's really like, you know, something that really interests me quite a bit.
Yeah, that's a good point. And even the way we talk to patients has to be different when they're expected to pay out of pocket. You're the county hospital, the VA, patients are paying this. Now, to bring in the whole cost conversation, that's a whole nother challenge, which honestly, I wasn't prepared for when I finished my training.
Absolutely. And I think it's gotten worse or more amplified.
Yeah.
Right? And because even if you're not going through, even if you're not paying for a, you know, premium technology like an ophthalmology practices, you know, a lot of the insurance plans now have high deductibles and higher co-pays, and
right,
patients are more and more faced with financial decisions as part of their medical decision-making process, which adds to the stress because now they have to pay for something they don't even understand what they're buying. And so that's really that's a challenge. That's a big challenge when I, you know, even listen to some of our experienced colleagues, you know, who are, you know, lecturing and teaching us from the podium. I mean, I think, you know, it's great to have new technologies, but a pathway to reimbursement, a pathway to, you know, that really can inhibit the way a practice array technology is adopted in the marketplace.
Right. No, for sure.
Right. It's not just having a great stent for glaucoma, but if the insurance companies won't reimburse it, patients have limited access to it. And then how do you help them understand? And how do you understand as a doctor how to get through that?
That is for sure. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Another great pearl I taught the young doctors was don't give a huge option list. Don't give them a menu with 100 things on it. You got to kind of narrow it down and what's appropriate for them. You know, as a physician, all right, for this patient, the best couple of options would be like between these two. And make it simple for the patient. Kind of help guide them.
What's crazy now is you might say, hey, here's these two options. And all of a sudden, our decisions now, what's really changed in 25 years is the challenge is what we recommend isn't what the insurance company allows, whether it's through prior authorizations, whether it's through coverage, whether it's through the 60 different plans of, you know, like Blue Cross that they have or Medicare Advantage. And so all of a sudden it's even hard to educate the patients because you're sitting there saying, here's the two great options for you. Wow, look at all these great choices you have. And then before you can get too excited about it, patients have to understand, okay, how much is it going to cost me really, even with insurance?
Right.
And so now there's this, you know, there's this challenge inside practices, and, you know, the young doctors coming out saying, oh, I just want to learn how to do this new technique, whether it's in glaucoma, whether it's premium IOLs. And all of a sudden it's like, well, you know, the patient, you know, is going to be saddled with, you know, could be saddled with a large copay, you know,
right. Yeah, for sure.
Because of their deductible, right? It is covered. They have insurance, but they have a $10,000 deductible. So all of a sudden that beautiful technology now is not free. And all of a sudden, you know, like you said, you get a complication with those situations, and all of a sudden it blows up into something larger because of that payment.
So true. I mean, I'm even my health insurance, I have a large deductible. Mm-hmm. So I'm paying it out of pocket. I'm just hopefully I won't have to use my insurance for something catastrophic, but everything else, the routine stuff, I'm just paying it, even though I have insurance. Because my deductible is, yeah, some multi-$1,000 figure.
Yeah. Yep. The new world. Reimbursement.
Yeah, that wasn't the case like 15 years ago, 10 years ago. You didn't have these like mega deductibles.
Yeah, back 25 years ago, like we had no choices, but everything was covered, right? Like we never had to talk about it. Yeah, you could upgrade to it. But nowadays we have more choices than ever in lenses and glaucoma procedures and dry eye therapies and presbyopia therapies and the type of coverage, the type of reimbursement a patient gets is unfortunately, you know, it takes up a large part of that conversation.
No, very, very, very true. You know, another change I've seen is we used to prescribe patients these drops, right? An antibiotic, a steroid, an NSAID.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone I know, obviously me included, is doing the compounded drops, make life easy. Much easier.
Yeah.
What a game changer.
Yeah, no, we also have access to those because, you know, if you're thinking about being a patient advocate, having those drops is critical, you know, and we're lucky that there are businesses and pharmacies out there, you know, that are providing that service to us. And, you know, it just gets frustrating because who's your doctor? Is it the insurance company, the person allowing, right. You know, or is it the doctor? And that's the philosophical, you know, frustration that I have is that, you know, here's a drop that I think you need. Mm-hmm. The actual drop that you get, whether it's a generic or a combination, is dictated by what the insurance companies decide to cover. So, you know, I think it is, you know, we're not gonna, this isn't about, you know, how to fix healthcare, but, you know, and we're lucky in ophthalmology that there are other options that still give patients good results. But, you know, there are some challenges now that weren't present years ago.
No, very different, very different. So would you give advice to, say, a young ophthalmologist says, all right, I'm finishing my training, my fellowship, is it still possible to start a practice de novo from scratch?
Absolutely. And I think that there's more opportunity than ever. And I, you know, I'm a strong believer in that. You know, I think a lot of the training programs, even outside of ophthalmology, I talked to some neighbors who are in orthopedics and other fields, and they're like, you know, I didn't think it was possible to still be in solo practice.
Right.
And that's disappointing to me that inside academics, they're teaching our young doctors to give away their independence and their freedom of, you know, choice in how to practice. And so it is very possible, especially in ophthalmology. You know, I can't speak to other fields, but in ophthalmology, I've seen a lot of younger surgeons pursuing their dream of having an independent practice. And if you do refractive procedures, if you do refractive cataract surgery, there's a big runway out there. And you know, the way to kind of get into it is, like you said, just like learning surgical techniques, talk to the people that are doing it, that have done it, visit the practices and see for yourself if that's something appealing to you. Because I gotta say it's to me, it's not as challenging as, you know, that maybe some of your mentors within academics have made it seem to be.
For sure.
Because I think, you know, to be fair, many of the peak of academics have never, it's not like they were in private practice and then went in academics. They've always been in academics, so they've never really tried this private practice lifestyle. And I think it's very possible, you know. I think it's, and now with the shortage and with, you know, there's more opportunity than ever. You don't have to join a huge group. You can still do it on your own or with a smaller group if you choose.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, look, you and I are both basically started solo, started from scratch. It takes some time to build momentum. You're not going to be an overnight success. Mm-hmm. But I think the investment is just well worth it. And there's just, it's, to be your own boss is priceless. You can do things that you probably couldn't do if you had a strict employer, right? You can't. I can take a month off. If I want to go travel and do something, I can take a whole month off. No problem.
Yeah, I think the flexibility of your schedule, how you want your schedule, you know, you have that ability. I think that's one of the things, but I think it's really, if you think on the big picture, you know, do administrators, you know, provide the, do you want to work within a bunch of administration and
right. Red,
or do you want to be able, does a patient really want that? You know, do they, I think they want to come to a doctor with a problem and get a solution. They want to know how much it's going to cost, how it's going to get covered. It's a very less complicated process than, you know, having to navigate a larger system. And, you know, maybe, you know, other people say there's lots of benefits to being part of a larger system, but that's why you have to know, like, who you are, what you want to do, how you want to do it, you know, in your life. And so your question was, is it possible? I think it's absolutely possible. I think it's more about who that person is, what their why is, and how they want to kind of, you know, see their career kind of unfold.
I think absolutely. There are obviously many different options for the young people in terms of solo practice, joining a small group, join a big group, join an HMO, do academics, do a private equity, whatever it is that makes you happy, do. But keep in mind, you definitely can still do this, and it's okay to switch gears. Your first job is like your first girlfriend or boyfriend. They're great and all, but may not be the one you're with forever. And that's okay.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Okay. Listen, okay, switch gears. We actually had edited a podcast early on, maybe a year ago. Young ophthalmologist, I just saw an article he wrote about how he started his practice from scratch.
Yep.
Young guy was joined a group that wasn't for him. And after a couple years, he left. And we talked all about how he set up and just kind of became the master of his own practice and just how life is so amazing.
Yeah, I think you said it right. I mean, if you have to get through and be patient, right? Because you're building your relationship. And again, we're so used to kind of being rewarded academically, right? If you study hard, you get straight A's, you get a good board score, you get into the top programs. But in the real world, that's not how you're competing with the person that graduated last from the residency class.
Right.
And so patients are judging you on a totally different level. And that takes some getting used to, you know, that there's a different measuring stick. But yeah, I'm glad for that person. I've seen other examples as well. You know, like we could all name the names and they're out there in the first 5 to 10 years of their independent solo practices and doing very, very well. So that's what I base my answer on. You know, I think I had a, you know, unique opportunity. We've created a good practice up here for ourselves, but it's fun to see, you know, others doing it right now, you know, that are 20 years younger than both of us, you know, so, and they're doing great.
Yeah. The world is definitely your oyster. Now, what do you think is coming down the road here? Are you guys doing like in-office surgery? Are you still using a surgery center?
Yeah, we're lucky. You know, I own my own surgery center. So, we've been lucky over the last, you know, 15 plus years to just be able to operate in our own surgery center.
Oh, fantastic.
Office. Yeah. So, you know, in-office surgery, I think, is, you know, gaining momentum. I think there's some hurdles and challenges, you know. I think I was past president of the Outpatient Ophthalmic Surgery Society, and there are definitely some, you know, regulatory and reimbursement hurdles. So sure. I think, you know, it just has to play out. I think it's, you know, I think it's, you know, here to stay because it is benefiting some of these practices, especially in some states with, you know, certificates of need.
Right.
And so, you know, I think we'll see. I think it awaits to be seen. You know, I think it awaits to be seen. But I think controlling that surgical experience is, I think, you know, important to the success when you're trying to build a premium practice. I think that's really important.
All right, you got a patient who's calling your office.
Yeah.
And wants to get rid of their glasses. What you said, the cocktail conversation. Hey, I want to get my glasses here. So now you offer a full spectrum of refractive surgery. You offer LASIK, PRK, you know, smile, you probably offer faking eye well, you offer refractive lens exchange, there's a spectrum.
Yes.
How does your team, I should say, even not just you, how does your team get the patient in the right kind of pathway?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. I think the first word is team. I think that, you know, the practices that have been successful with this have developed a team around the surgeon that begins the education process. So it's team and education. at least that's our approach. Our approach is, you know, probably a little more conservative than some that I've seen, but it starts with education. It ends with education, you know,
yeah,
but
for sure.
It's the team around. So we have a telehealth team that starts the conversation before the patient comes into the office for their appointment. So they don't just get, you know, hit with seven different options before they come into the office. Because, you know, even when like we walk into Starbucks and try to choose what kind of coffee we want, that menu on there is like so confusing. And you know, what do you do as an old guy? We just default to, I'll just take the dark roast.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, you can't even decide this. Just give me the medium, whatever. It's not even called medium, right? But so if there's too many choices, like you said earlier, patients can freeze. So knowing what the options are before they come in has helped us. And then, you know, we spend a lot of time not just educating about the medical stuff that they have, like, hey, you have a cataract or you have nearsightedness or you have a high degree of nearsightedness. Here's the different technologies that would work for your specific situation. We spend a lot of time educating about what that's going to cost them.
Sure.
Because they make decisions, you know, like, hey, what should I do? You know, you said that this ICL, Evo ICL is, you know, right for me, or I could do either that or SMILE or, you know, LASIK. And there's different costs between, you know, depending on the practice, there could be different costs between all three of those techniques. So that enters into their mind, right? So a lot of times they're like, well, I can't afford that. How does this work for me? So it all of a sudden becomes a consumer conversation, you know, not just I'm the doctor, here's your best choice, and here's what it costs. You know, you have to give them a strong recommendation.
Right.
But they need some education so they, right? They don't have all these questions behind the scenes, right? Oh, doctor, you know, Uday told me to do this, but I still, God, could I have done that other thing and gotten the same thing?
Right.
So, you know, I really have to pay this much money, you know? Unfortunately, those are part of the conversations. And even with insurance, they have to know, like, you know, what's my copay? What's my deductible? How does this fit into my life? You know, have you noticed in your practice, in the first part of the year, January, February, some people's cataracts aren't even covered because of their high deductible.
Right.
So a basic cataract without any upgrade can cost these people $10,000
for right.
a multifocal basic lens wearing glasses. And then you're trying to talk to them about, look at this great lifestyle lens I have. Just another $10,000 on top of that, whatever it is. And they're like, I can't do that. Right. $20,000 for most people is a lot of money.
It's a lot of money for everyone. The tough part there is, yeah, you're right. At the end of the year, December, like, hey, I want surgery right now. My deductible's met.
Yeah.
And then January, when it resets, you're like, whoa.
Yeah. Remember when January used to be the busiest time for cataracts, but because of high deductibles and copays, you know, it's not a slower time. I mean, but it's changed, right? Like the end of the year becomes, you know, a very, very critical time now.
But yeah, crunch time.
Yeah. So to answer your question, it starts with team, starts with education, and then it ends with education about every aspect of the journey.
Now I gotta ask, because you're a Minneapolis guy, you're obviously no stranger to snow and bad wind, cold weather. Because I'm in LA, the seasons are almost the same. Does that play a role in surgical volume? Do patients have less surgery in the cold months and more in the warmer months, or the opposite? I'm not sure.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's changed over the 25 years, though. But, you know, typically 25 years ago, and it was mostly, you know, cataract type surgeries, January and February were very slow, or much slower relative to the summer months, because of that snowbird phenomenon where people leave for the winter to go south. And that's why, you know, some of our friends down in Florida, you know, do more cataract surgery on Minnesotans than the Minnesota doctors. So we love them anyway. But and now people seem to be staying down longer. So they leave earlier, you know, they used to leave in November. They come back earlier, like in March or something sometimes. And now they leave in October and they come back in May.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's changed. But, you know, other procedures, like refractive procedures are different. So the younger population kind of keeps it more steady. But yeah, you definitely have this phenomenon of
seasonal
in our area. Just, I mean, the reverse is true. Like if you live in some of the retirement type states, you know, our a lot of our patients go to Florida, but Texas, Palm Desert, even, you know,
right.
places for some of the Minnesota snowbirds.
Yeah, it's a lot of them fly down there, come back home pseudo fake. You're like, wait a minute, my last note said you had cataracts.
Yeah, I got a note from Dr. Dubkin saying that, you know, would you be Dr. Chu'd be happy to see you post-op. Happy to see your patients today. No problem.
Now, don't have too many Minnesota patients coming to see me. It's okay. They don't summer out here. They're summering out in Florida.
Yeah, they do. A lot of that. A lot of that.
What's coming down the road for us in terms of new technologies? What do you think is coming?
That's, you know, I think from what I can see out there, I mean, you're starting to see continuous investment and improvement in different lenses, right? You know, right. I think there's still some interest in a lens that can actually potentially provide some accommodation or, you know, even pseudo accommodation. We've had, you know, you and I worked on crystallines quite a bit together and did that journey. And I know you're part of some, you know, other new startups that are out there. And so I think that's still something that people are kind of curious and interested about. Like having a true accommodating IOL would be pretty amazing.
Yeah, for sure.
having adjustable accommodating IOL would be amazing, you know? But to even have an adjustable lens now has been a really amazing thing for us and our patients, just as a side thing. I think you'll see different investments in refractive surgery. I think you'll see some new lasers coming out. I think you'll see maybe some innovations on the implantable contact lens side, you know, maybe trying to help with, you know, other challenges we have, like with presbyopia. So those are the holy grail. I think, you know, people are focused on how to fix presbyopia.
Sure.
You know, how to give a more natural vision through lens implants. So I think you're going to see a lot of investment there. And then therapeutics is still big. You know, I think therapeutics in our world, you know, presbyopia drops have been introduced. Super exciting to have that option. And I think you'll still see some other ones coming out that, you know, can maybe keep improving and growing that marketplace, you know, kind of addressing some of the issues of the first generation type presbyopia correcting drops. Yeah, that's kind of the stuff that I see from, you know, my limited perch in the world.
Yeah, I think presbyopia would be a huge one. Now I got to ask, we're on the same age. How are you dealing with presbyopia? What are you doing?
I tolerate monovision, so I'm doing good. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. No, I've tried it. It's not bad. I'm a minus two OU, so I just like take them off.
There you go. Like,
wow, I love the world.
I got it. I can see. It's awesome.
But no, I may have to, you know, help develop these presbyopia solutions. So when it's time for me to, you know, get some surgery done, I get something really beautiful. But I think that's, you brought something up I didn't even think about. Yeah, you could do a phakic lens with some sort of presbyopia, maybe extended depth of focus on it, or that'd be a nice way to correct even these 50-year-olds who come in with refract. That's like the challenge. You, the 50-year-old who's minus two comes in and says, well, no, just fix my distance vision.
Yeah, think of that. And all the pseudofix
that didn't have the option. The lens.
That didn't have the option in the past. So there's a lot of I think there's a lot of opportunity. There's the presbyopes that, you know, are born into it naturally, right? They just didn't have any surgery.
Right.
And then there's the ones that we've created, whether it's through LASIK, whether it's through implants. And so there is I think, you know, there's a huge market opportunity there. So I think you're still going to see a lot of investment in that area.
Yeah, that'd be a really killer idea. Get something going there.
Yeah, put me on the patent. Don't steal that, man.
I'm sure that's already just tied up in patents. I'm sure these are all being developed.
But, absolutely, yeah.
but it's, you know, it's a fascinating time here to you know, obviously do ophthalmology, especially cataract refractive. And it's interesting, too, is how things have changed. Like when we were earlier in our careers, there was not a whole lot of glaucoma innovation, whereas now it's like, wow.
Yeah, dear, I remember that distinctly. And it's been cool to see. But yeah, I mean, it's with the aging population, with the technologies there and that investment, it's been wild to see, you know, glaucoma celebrities now, you know, on the podiums. And, you know, they're all good friends of ours. But it used to be all the cataract guys doing phaco when we were growing up, right? Like all the legends that we've known, like the
Simpsons. That was the cool stuff, right?
All that. Now you have, you know, it's like the glaucoma combination surgeons and the complex anterior segment and, you know, refractive, there's innovations, but, you know, once you, the techniques have been relatively stable for a long time. So, but yeah, it's been cool to see. Do you do a little bit of MIGS too?
Sure.
Why not? Right. I think it's a staple. I think as a modern cataract surgeon, MIG surgery should be part of your technique.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, I was lucky when that when I was a resident for 20 years, I also did like an omnibus valve a week with them for neovascular glaucoma.
Oh my God.
So I'm very well versed in like tubes and trabs and you name it. And at the county hospital, you don't refer it out. The buck stops there. You can take care of the patient, whatever it is.
Amazing.
So you got to do a whole lot of stuff. Now my life is much easier. It's like basically lots of just IOL. My lineup is just cataracts, a little bit of LASIK.
Yeah.
I love how, you know, cataract volume too has grown so much. I mean, nationwide numbers since we first started probably have doubled the number of cataracts per year in America. LASIK, unfortunately, has not grown like that. Why is it stagnant?
A lot of people have looked into it. I don't think anybody could put their finger on one exact thing, but for some reason, that just, you know, it kind of had a peak in the early 2000s and then now has dropped, you know, during some of the financial and global crises and just has not kind of regained momentum like we would have expected. So, but I still think it's important. I think it's one of those things where it's kind of like a expected almost if you're going to be a refractive surgeon. I mean, like I said, people still think, hey, can I get rid of my glasses and contacts? And it's cool to have that privilege. So I stay in that space of gratitude that, you know, I know how to do it. We have the ability to help people. And when they choose to do it, they get a good result. That's right. That's why we did it in the first place.
You get a fantastic result. I mean, you obviously know from our LASIK patients that the number of patients who are 20/20 and beyond is amazing.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
And that brings up a point. You know, I think, as ophthalmologists, you know, we have to realize that, you know, the enemy isn't each other, right? It's not me competing against you. It is us competing against the fear of the that's in the marketplace. So the pie is huge. I mean, what's that number? Like 4 to 6 million people a year discontinue contact lens wear because they can't wear contacts. But the number of refractive surgeries through LASIK that is done is only like 600,000 in the United States. So what happened to that other 3.5 million people that can't wear contacts? They're just wearing glasses now?
Yeah.
So the enemy isn't that, you know, the doctor across town is taking your patients. The enemy is somewhere else outside of our community. And so I think that's an important message for the young doctors, because, you know, at first you can be like, oh, I'm competing against the guy down the street. And really you're competing against the mind of the consumer. Like, why aren't they seeking it from all of us, not just, you know, you individually as a doctor?
That is such sage advice, that you're not ever competing with your colleagues in the same city. You're not. I'm not competing with anyone.
Yeah, and you got a lot of ophthalmologists around you. So that's, yeah.
For sure. You compete with yourself, but yeah, you're competing with the mindset of patient fear. That's a big deal. Like I had, even IOL surgeries, I had a patient who was monocular from an accident and he sees a retina doc and the retina doc says, no, you go fix that cataract. And the guy's scared out of his mind. And so it's just like, you know, the fear. I think, yeah, you're right. We're not worried about taking a bigger piece of a small pie. We need to grow the pie.
You need to grow the pie. And I, you know, it's the other thing that, you know, you talked about personal stuff. I mean, it's I'm a foodie, so I love food, right? But I love, you know, the excellence that chefs dedicate themselves to providing the hospitality experience through food, right? I see it as an artistic expression. I see it as a way of connecting with people. But just because somebody gets a 3 Michelin star, it doesn't mean you're going to like their restaurant.
Correct. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And you may, and it's a very human interaction, human experience. So, you know, I don't take it personally when somebody chooses another practice. In fact, you want them to choose another practice, because if they don't trust you enough to choose you, then you don't want them either. Right. And it's nothing personal. It's not about your skills. It's not, I mean, it's, you just may not like the flavor of their food. You may not, you know, you may not want it. And so they shouldn't choose you, right? I mean, to have that attitude of, you know, I need to do a certain number of procedures per year, per month to be known as the most, isn't how, to me, you know, the 3 Michelin star restaurants are built. That's how, you know, large food chains are built.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality is different. So I think that's part of the why, that's part of the mentality for, you know, some of the younger surgeons out there, is that it's a human interaction. And not everybody's going to choose you, and that's okay because you may not choose them. So that's right. That's an interesting thing that we're not taught, right? And I'm not advocating for, you know, denying care. I'm just saying that it is a human interaction that people have choices, and we're lucky that in refractive surgery, it's an elective procedure. You have your choice.
For sure. And I also like your point where, yes, the patient has to choose you, but you also have to choose or accept the patient. Because yeah, I had a patient recently, and just said, you know, I said, thank you for coming today. Yes, you certainly need cataract surgery, but I'm not the surgeon for you. And she was just taken aback, and she says, but she says, I really want you to do the surgery. I said, I can appreciate that. It's nice to want things, but I said, I don't want to do it. And she's like, why? And I said, well, I don't think I can actually meet your expectations. Like, I know the limitations of surgery, at least the surgery I deliver. I know what the limits are. And I think your expectations are not going to be met. So for that reason, I politely decline to do your surgery.
That's amazing. You know, and that's sage wisdom too, because, you know, our sentence is very similar, but, you know, to learn this sentence took many, many years and many, many, you know, hard knocks in a sense. You know, you, as a surgeon, you can say, I can't give you what you need from the surgery.
Right.
Which is not necessarily a technical result, right? It's, mm-hmm. it's, I can't, you know, and I learned this from my plastic surgeon colleagues, right? You know, just because you do a surgery for, you know, image improvement, whatever it is, whatever part of the body, you're not also fixing their mental status. Or right. if the patient feels like they're trying to get surgery to fix their life, not their eyes.
Right.
And no one can give them what they need from the surgery. And that's a hard thing to learn, you know, because they might have legitimate eye problems, cataracts, refractive error, whatever, but that they may be attaching other things to that. And that's, you know, something for the young surgeons to learn too. You know, learn from your other colleagues in other fields like dermatology, like plastic surgery, like pain management, right? Even something that these people, you know, have very many challenges, but you have to figure out what problem you're really trying to solve and what you are doing, does that solve their problem?
That's so important. I had a patient I did surgery on where afterwards she's like, no, my life is ruined. I can't do anything. I mean, you're 20/20 minus. You're Plano minus 75 at like 90. I mean, how is your life over? Pre-op, you were 20 out of 80 with a 3+ nuclear cataract and cortical spokes and your visual axis. And so you're right. They're attaching some other part of their other problems, psych issues, mental problems, are attaching it all to this. And now it's just like the blame is on that surgery. Oof, those were tough.
Yeah, it can be. And trying to identify that beforehand is an important part of the process.
Right.
What they're looking for, what problem they're trying to solve, right? Business people ask that all the time. What problem are you trying to solve? And we were never taught that. We're just taught to whatever problem comes through the door, we try to find a solution. And not everybody appreciates that solution, even though the outcome of the solution may be technically perfect, you know?
Right. Right. No, I totally agree with you. It's just like we get some big challenges there. But you said earlier that the important part is your team. And I've learned that, yeah, if you have a great team, if any of your team members say, doctor, this patient may not be a great surgery candidate. And I say, oh, what do you mean? You think the patient has like, you know, FFKC or the cornea is a little bit irregular? Like, it has nothing to do with the measurements, doctor. This patient, you'll see, but just be cautious. You take that advice to heart, like, oh, I really trust this person. Let me go see them. And you're right. Yep, you're right.
That's important. You know, I think you said the word trust. Trust your team. You know, they trust that you're a good surgeon, that you're going to, you know, not harm people. But then it's super empowering for them. And we do the same thing that, you know, at every level of the practice, their feedback is important. You know, how the patient behaves when they hear how much something costs, how the patient behaves when they're not able to get the technology that they thought they wanted, you know, for medical reasons, for whatever reason. And so, you know, having that conversation, that trust is important. I think that that's unique. Not every practice and not every, but because each one of us is unique. And so that's one of the beauties of being able to be independent, you know, kind of tying it back to that. You get to have the way you like to make decisions kind of be part of your culture, right?
Right, right. If you're in a situation where you can't say no to a patient who needs surgery or wants surgery, then that makes it a lot more challenging on you.
Yeah. You know, that's been brought out in the media in the refractive area for years, you know, recently in the Wall Street Journal, where quotas were what was important. And so, and that sometimes quotas sometimes, you know, were in conflict with what the doctor's judgment was. And so that's where it became an issue, right? And so I think that's, you know, that's a boundary that, you know, I don't think should be violated, right? And so that's what we went to school for, you know, to kind of set that boundary. So I'm not saying it's common and widespread. I'm just saying that, you know, for the young surgeons out there, sometimes dangling a little relatively high paycheck in front of them, you know, it's not worth it.
That's a hard lesson to learn. And honestly, in my 30s, I don't know, that would have fallen on my deaf ears in my 30s. It takes some time, maybe mid-30s, I finally kind of, someone knocked some sense into me. It's just a little bit of school of hard knocks. In fact, one of the reasons I do this podcast is we learn so many things from just being kicked, from failing, from falling down. And so we can pass that knowledge, because on the video side, the surgery side, I can show you, like, here's what's leading up to a fake wound burn. Here's how to prevent a fake wound burn. And you can learn that, and you never have to experience that complication.
Sure.
But like similarly in these podcasts, one of the things I like to get at is, and why there's no set agenda, is that I want to be able to like share like secrets and pearls of success. So the young people can say, okay, you know what? This is something I gotta pay more attention to. And they'll learn from us and not have to be kicked and not have to fall down so many times.
Yeah. 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 And a lot of it though, what I've seen just from my limited interaction is with the different generations of docs is that, not to sound all cliche, it depends on, they have to take some responsibility too, right?
For sure.
They have to have the drive. They have to have that humbleness to respect the, you know, that there's still, once you graduate from a program and even in your first several years of practice, there's still so much more you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And even now at this stage, 25 years in, you know, the pearl for success is that, you know, I don't really know. I know less for sure now than I did when I was 31. Right. I think because of that, you know, I'm a better doctor. And so, yeah. Right. Because I understand, like, wait, I really don't know why, you know, this is happening so much of the time, but I know how to explain it to you.
Right.
That here, we're in this together, that, you know, some things happen. This is surgery. We're in this together. There's more that we're not in control of than we think we're in control of. But then how we handle that journey together through the uncertainty is the decision you're making to have surgery with me. And meaning, like, you know, I tell some of my young staff, part of the decision-making process is if something were to happen unexpected, and it might not even be something visually threatening,
mm-hmm.
does that patient trust us and you, the team, enough to go through that process with you?
Right.
Not that they just want the surgery, but do they trust enough that, okay, I chose this place because I trust them when things go not according to plan.
Mm-hmm.
And right, those are some of your happiest patients, I'm sure, over the years, is that, wait, we had this unexpected situation, but we still got them to, you know, what we say is 2020, right? 20 happy.
Right.
Right. And some of the most unhappy patients are 2020. Like all are, you know, the unhappy patients are 2020. It's not a visual issue.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Can you get them through? And so, you know, managing that emotional state, managing that understanding and trust is really, that's the challenge.
Absolutely. Like when you're not taught this enough, when the patient has a complication, whether it's iatrogenic, whether it's just bad luck, whether it's whatever the issue is, something unexpected, as you said, they have to know that you're not going to abandon them, that you're going to say, hey, you and I together, we'll take care of this. We'll get you through this. And so in the resident, sometimes you think, okay, oh God, complication, come back to clinic like never, I don't want to see you again. Whereas you need to do the opposite. You need to be like, no, you and I are now buddies. We're going to go through this process together. We're going to get you taken care of, but I need to see you more and more. You got to bring your complication patients closer, not push them away.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, I see that less in this next generation, but that's the thing where, you know, not all of our colleagues feel that way. Right. Cause you can also weaponize that against against your competition. But I think really what's important is that there's more uncertainty out there, and there's very, very few. I can't even count on, you know, one hand the number of doctors that I've seen that are purposely trying to hurt somebody.
Oh no, yeah. People we're right.
Things just happen. We're like good people, like, you know, and then things happen, and in reality, you're all in this together. Even in a community, you're all in this together. So kind of understanding that is, I think, one of the critical things, you know, to learn as a young doctor.
Absolutely. You're all basically playing on the same team. We're only graduating 400 or 500 ophthalmologists in the country per year. Per country. Believe me, we're all on the same team here. And that's similarly, another great lesson I should tell the young docs is, you see a patient, had surgery elsewhere, and you see the eye, and clearly there were some issues. There's some iris atrophy, iris damage, they got a sulcus lens, it's not perfectly centered, maybe a little bit of the wound. I said, give the other surgeon the benefit of the doubt. Because when you do the patient's second eye, don't be cocky. Because that patient likely has bad protoplasm, weak zone. You're going to have the exact same issues. You're going to make the paresthesis, and you're going to iris prolapsing up the paras.
Exactly. Patient squeeze. Yeah, you. Yeah, we've all been there.
Yep. Give the first surgeon the benefit of the doubt. That's absolutely.
That's it.
Remember, the only surgeons, the only cataract surgeons who've never dropped a nucleus are the ones who are good at lying. And the rare times it happens, I put the video up online so you can see, you can watch me.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah.
So just like, you're right, it happens. And it's not always just surgeon fault. It's like patient tissue. Like, patient comes in, looks like a good surgeon. They had some CME done. They want me to do the second eye. Let's tell the patient, you know what the biggest risk factor is for CME in the other eye? Is that you had the first eye.
Yeah.
And I said, the second eye, even with a perfect surgery, has a 50% coin flip chance of having CME again. It's your tissues. It's not the way that it is surgery. I promise you.
Yeah. But the fact you said it before the surgery is the key. And, the first surgeon, you know, talked about it as a potential risk of cataracts and had it in the consent form. But since it's rare enough and it just happened to be, you know, so the second surgeon has the benefit of that roadmap of what happened on the first eye. And so you're right. You got to be compassionate, you know, for your colleagues, but also for, you know, for the patient, you know, like, I mean, they might be questioning and nervous. And so, you know, words matter, you know, and I think that's something that, you know, has to be taught. You know, you just can't, you know, that's, oh, this wouldn't have happened to me. You know,
don't be so sure, partner.
I wouldn't have done that. It's like, well, you know, you weren't there, and so we hope it doesn't happen to you. You know,
right. But yeah, keep in mind, yeah, what happened to the first eye, very likely to happen to the second. That CME thing is actually a published study. 50% risk of the second eye if it had happened to the first eye. It's just like, because that's the patient. You got ERMs, you got vitreomagnetic retraction, you got whatever you got some bad protoplasm.
Undiagnosed disease, right? Diabetes, something.
Oh, yeah, diabetics for sure.
Yeah. They don't even know I'm not diabetic. Well, I mean, now we found out.
Well, yeah, I hear that too. Well, I'm not really diabetic. I just have a touch of the sugar.
Touch of the sugar, yeah, yep. And you can see the body habit is, you can see everything. It's like, well, maybe you should get it checked.
Right. Oh, wow. These are such great pearls. Gosh, like, I wish I had recorded this and given it to myself 20 years ago to learn all these things.
Well, that's great. No, I think it's been a wild journey, and it's been a fun conversation, kind of, you know, sharing our insights, what we've had, and they sound very similar. And yeah, hopefully this provides, you know, some insight into what it's like to still be in solo practice after 25 years.
Yeah, honestly, it's a great thing. It is a great thing. I think there's so much good in it. And then, like you said, you really can determine, okay, what's best for my practice? What's best for my patient? You're the captain of the ship. And there's a fun in that for sure.
Yeah. And we're starting the next chapter this September. So
that is fun.
Next journey begins.
I'm so happy for you. I'm sure it'll be a fantastic experience. And I bet you Dr. Sullivan's watched Cataract Coach videos, so we're good. I'm a fan already.
I told her about this, so, you know, I think, you know, now she'll know. Hi, Marianne.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you, Ralph, for doing that. I really appreciate it. I mean, I've enjoyed our friendship so much over the years. Now I got to get myself to Minneapolis so I can go to like all these amazing restaurants that you've sussed out over the city.
Yes, we welcome you all times. And again, I appreciate our friendship as well. And thanks for inviting me to be on your podcast.
All righty. Hey, and I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, I got a new podcast every single Sunday, top podcast in all of ophthalmology. Plus, of course, we got a new cataract coach video every single day. We're up to like 2,300 videos by now. Wow, mind blown. I will see you every day for cataract coach video. And of course, next week for our podcast. See you then.